From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. This week, environmental and indigenous activists were handed a huge, you might even say stunning, victory.
Need to move on. We got some breaking news on the Dakota Access Pipeline. Lauren, what
the Dakota Access Pipeline must shut down within 30 days in a big win for the Native American tribes.
A federal judge on the D.C. District Court told the company that owns the Dakota Access Pipeline that it had to shut the pipeline down and drain it of oil.
They want a lengthy environmental review to take place for Sioux Native American tribes fear environmental harm because of this pipeline.
The Dakota Access Pipeline last dominated the news in 2016 into 2017 when a prolonged protest led by the Standing Rock Sioux tribe drew indigenous people from all over North America in a last bid effort to stop the construction of the project.
Yesterday, demonstrators supporting the Standing Rock Sioux tribe faced off with private security officers from Dallas-based Energy Transfer Partners.
You have to get off the pickup and move to the south.
It did get built and filled with oil, even as the legal battle continued. In March, a judge ruled that the Army Corps of Engineers had made serious mistakes in its environmental review of the pipeline and failed to consider the impact of a possible spill on resources guaranteed to the Sioux by various treaties and laws. The company says the decision will cost them $643 million in lost revenue for the end of 2020 and another $1.4 billion if it stays empty through 2021. However, the judge wrote, "The fact that Dakota Access did assume much of its economic risk knowingly and the potential harm each day the pipeline operates, the court is forced to conclude that the flow of oil must cease. In other words, it's not the law's job to guarantee the profits of a private company." And what is the law when it comes to a sovereign nation within another sovereign nation? To untangle the complicated history of treaties made, kept, and violated, as well as the Supreme Court decisions that constitute so-called native law, we turn to Kristen Carpenter, director of the American Indian Law Program at the University of Colorado Boulder. She explained that the Great Sioux Nation, which was a confederacy of the Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota peoples, first penned a treaty with the United States in 1851, laying out what their recognized territories would be, attempting to stop the encroachment of white settlers. But that agreement wouldn't last long.
And so even having negotiated the 1851 treaty, the federal government came back for more land in the 1868 treaty. What's, I think, particularly notable is that even having secured the agreement of the tribes, the government nonetheless went ahead and broke those treaties and sanctioned the entrance of non-Indians into the territory, even though it had promised not to do that.
One thing I read is that President Ulysses S. Grant actually refused or stated that he would not defend native land, which then sort of opened the way to encroachment onto those treaty territories.
Yes, it's such a tragic history because I think from the tribe's perspective, they really took as sacred solemn promises the agreements that they negotiated with the federal government. And when the president then essentially invited non-Indians into the territory and shirked the United States' responsibility to protect those lands, the Sioux people were extremely vulnerable.
So in 1876, there was another agreement that was signed, and this one is rather infamous. Can you talk about what happened?
What was known as the Indian Wars of the 70s, the seven bands of the Lakota Sioux were ordered back to the reservation because they were in their unceded territory engaging in, you know, many activities, most notably hunting, hunting buffalo, because they needed to be able to feed their families, of course. And the United States ordered them back to the reservation. And this was, of course, incredibly contested by starving people who needed to support their families the way they always had. And so that there were a number of battles and wars. And ultimately, the Sioux were ordered back to their reservation.
In that 1876 agreement, it was signed by less than 10% of the adult males in the tribe, when in reality, they needed 3/4 of them for it to be valid, which is eventually what led to the Supreme Court striking it down.
Yes, in 1980, when the U.S. Supreme Court went back and looked at that agreement, it found that it had violated the treaty and therefore ordered monetary damages for taking the land.
Monetary damages, which the Sioux never accepted. And indeed, they requested the return of the majority of the Black Hills land that are now under federal ownership.
That's exactly right. And this set of events gave rise to the famous statement that the Black Hills are not for sale. And that's because these are sakred lands to the Lakota, Nakota, and Dakota people. They can't be compensated through a monetary payment. And the Sioux people were clear in all of their modern litigation through the Indian Claims Commission and so on, that what they sought was return of the land. And as you said, the tribes have refused to take that money. It has remained in a treasury account that I think at this point is worth over $1 billion, but they still cannot take the money because that would be giving up their claims to the land.
When I was trying to research this history, one of the things that struck me was how many of the events that are part of all the backstory that are things that are actually, you know, taught in history textbooks. So the Sioux Wars, Custer's Last Stand, quote unquote, the Massacre at Wounded Knee, that these are things that do now today continue to have this legal relevance. And I guess what I'm wondering here is why it is that American culture has sort of remained fixated and has reproduced versions of these events so many times.
Well, I think that unfortunately, in many ways, the United States hasn't yet accounted for a number of aspects of its racialized history. And we see, for example, the unacknowledged and unremedied aspects of slavery coming back to affect contemporary treatment of African Americans in our society and the Black Lives Matter movement, calling for accountability and remedies. And I think we see the same thing or a similar thing in American Indian issues. The takings of Indian lands are only partly acknowledged in the history books. And for the most part, they're unremedied. As we've just talked about in the Sioux Nation case, United States continues illegally to claim ownership of the Black Hills. Those are Sioux lands. And we could, as a nation, I believe that as a democratic nation, we have the ideals, we certainly have the legal processes, we could remedy those injuries. We could, for example, in the public lands context, figure out some methodologies of restitution or at the very least co-management of the Black Hills that would recognize the Sioux Nation's presence and relationship with the lands and perhaps alleviate some of these ongoing harms that come from that deep, dark history that you've alluded to.
We're talking to Kristen Carpenter, director of the American Indian Law Program at the University of Colorado Boulder, because this has been a very bad week for pipelines. On Sunday, the developer of a pipeline that would have crossed under the Appalachian Trail announced that they would pull the plug for economic reasons. On Monday, the Supreme Court issued a brief that effectively blocks the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, and the same day, a district court ruled that the Dakota Access Pipeline, which was already completed, needed to be drained of oil. Kristen Carpenter is laying out the long legal history of the continual encroachment on Sioux lands that is the backdrop to the Dakota Access decision. So maybe we could take a moment to talk about the Dakota Access case itself. Can we start by just getting a quick reminder of the story of the pipeline and how it came to be that this case was before the courts.
Right. So this takes us back at least to 2016, which is when I and many others became aware of this case. But it actually goes back a little bit further to Energy Transfer Partners' interest in building a pipeline to carry oil from the Bakken region of North Dakota to its markets, going all the way down across the country to the Gulf of Mexico. And there were several potential routes. One of them identified would have gone closer to some of the major cities of North Dakota, and the largely white citizens of those cities did not want an oil pipeline going through their lands because they were worried about some of the same things the Sioux people have been worried about, both the disruption of construction, interference with property rights, and the potential for leaks. And so ultimately, Dakota Access Pipeline worked with the Army Corps of Engineers to identify a place on the federal public lands that could be used to transport the oil. And that's how they ended up along the Missouri River at Lake Oahe and under the jurisdiction of the federal government. If you look at maps, you'll see that those lands are, you know, relatively close to the reservation lands, but they're just far enough off the reservation that the tribes don't have direct jurisdiction over them anymore. So the Army Corps granted that permit, and it did so in a way that did not fully discharge the obligations to consult with the Indian tribes who would be affected. And so because the construction was set to go without sufficient input of the tribes and over their objection, many people, led by some Lakota women elders, gathered at that spot along the Cannonball River to protest and to use their voices and their bodies and their lives to try to protect the land and the water, given that the law wasn't at least yet working to do so.
You wrote back in 2016 that the protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline were sort of awakening or reawakening a movement of indigenous resistance here in the United States. Do you still think that's true? And to what extent is that something that has continued to gain steam?
It's absolutely true. And I remember being along the Cannonball River, and I was there for a few days in October of 2016, camping out with a number of members of Standing Rock and Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, and really incredibly impressed by the seriousness of their commitment and determination to protect these lands and waters, and in fact, their entire way of life. And it was a multi-generational gathering. There were little kids there all the way up to elders. And it was international. It really wasn't just people in the American Indian and tribal advocacy movement, but indigenous peoples from all over the world. There were Sami people from Norway, and there were Maya people from Guatemala, and indigenous people coming from all quarters of the earth, recognizing the resonance of this moment and expressing their solidarity with the Sioux people. It was very painful, I think, for everyone, but certainly the people who were there for months and months, when in 2017, President Trump signed the executive order allowing the pipeline to be completed, that is the construction underneath Lake Oahe, and oil began to flow because people had really promised to dedicate their voices and their lives to this struggle. But I think one thing that's really notable in this recent decision reveals it is that the struggle did not end when the oil started flowing, and the tribes kept litigating, arguing that the Army Corps had failed to justify its decision not to require an environmental impact statement. That is the higher level of environmental review. And now here we are, 4 years later, it's 2020, after 2016, and the tribes have been vindicated. And it's the energy of that movement, it's their resilience, it's their persistence expressed on the front lines there in North Dakota, but also in the courts, that, in my view, has led the DC District Court to hold that the oil must be removed from the pipeline for the next 13 months or so while an environmental impact statement is prepared.
I spoke to Carpenter on Thursday, the same day that a landmark Supreme Court decision had been announced, McGirt versus Oklahoma, which ruled that despite years of slow encroachment and private land sales, much of the eastern half of Oklahoma should still be considered part of the reservation of the Muscogee Creek people, since Congress had never said otherwise. It was another striking win in the courts for Native people. You know, it's funny because a lot of lawyers and judges will sort of say the law is the law and decisions that are reached in courts are just reached because that's what the law says. But studies have shown that, especially in the Supreme Court, that the decisions that are made often do track in some sort of lagged, somewhat slow way public opinion. And obviously this is not the Supreme Court, but we did have a Supreme Court decision today in the McGirt case. And so I guess, you know, given these two decisions that the Dakota Access decision earlier this week and the McGirt decision today, what do you think it tells us about where the court is when it comes to these questions of indigenous law?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the McGirt case. And as you know, the U.S. Supreme Court today held in a 5-4 decision that the treaty guaranteed lands of the Muscogee Creek Nation were never disestablished by Congress. And so the Muscogee Creek Nation retains its reservation in northeastern Oklahoma, a reservation that they were promised when they were relocated by the federal government from their traditional lands in the southeast of the United States in the 1930s and settled in Indian Country, which is now Oklahoma. I think that, as I was saying earlier, our country, the United States, has ideals that sometimes, and when it's acting as its best self, it realizes. And one of them is that great nations, like great men, keep their promises, and treaties are the supreme law of the land.
For those who don't know, you were just referencing a famous dissent by Justice Black in a Supreme Court case.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it goes to the role of the rule of law in our country. And, you know, we, for better or for worse, but hopefully for better, have agreed to be bound by a social contract in which we as citizens elect members of Congress to represent us. And we allocate to different branches of government certain responsibilities to carry out the law. And so the executive branch enters into treaties, which the Senate then ratifies, and the courts are supposed to enforce. In a case like McGirt, that actually happened. And it's such an incredible moment for justice all these years later. And the Muscogee Creek Nation, you know, suffering the Trail of Tears, the dismantling of its government in anticipation of statehood in the early 1900s, the loss of so many tribal leaders and infringement on religion and culture, to have those fundamental promises guaranteed all this time later really speaks to their resilience and persistence, but also to the potential of the United States to live up to those promises and to act as the democracy that it really is. Unfortunately, as we talked about, the treaty history of the Sioux Nation while vindicated in by the Supreme Court in 1980 to some extent, meaning that case awarding damages for the violation of the treaty, has not similarly resulted in full land rights. And so there hasn't been restitution of the Black Hills, as we were discussing. The McGirt case suggests that, you know, we really do have the potential in our government and in our country for something more. And it would have to happen through a different mechanism here with respect to the Sioux people. But I think it would be possible for us to, as a government, as a society, to recognize the land rights more fully of the Sioux people. And there are, you know, lots of mechanisms for doing that.
The company that owns the Dakota Access Pipeline asked for an emergency ruling delaying the decision, but the judge turned them down. Perhaps that decision will be appealed. Perhaps a full environmental impact statement will be completed and will be favorable for the pipeline company, and perhaps the pipeline will be filled with oil again at some point. But for now, it has been ordered drained of oil by August 5th. This sordid history of treaties bent and broken reminds us of another that we reported on, one to our north. After a break, we revisit the backstory to the hydropower that supplies New England's electricity grid. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. At the risk of extreme understatement, the United States isn't the only country that has treated its native people poorly. Back in 2017, producer Hannah McCarthy and I spent a big chunk of the year reporting a series of stories about the complicated history of the provincially owned hydropower company, Hydro-Québec. The Dakota Access decision this week reminded us of those stories, in part because some of the people that we interviewed had actually traveled to the Cannonball River to protest alongside the Standing Rock Sioux. So here again is the second installation of that series, which told the story of the electricity that already powers about 7% of New England's electric grid, and in the coming decade, might account for even more.
Test, test, test. Okay.
This is Madame Marianne Hervieux. She's a member of the Pessimit, which is part of the Innu Nation. And this is the story she told us. When Marianne was young, she says she lived with her grandparents and her brother. Every year at the end of August, they would get into a big canoe and paddle up the Outard River toward Lake Plaitipie. This was more than 250 miles of paddling against the current on a big, wild Canadian river.
She says the trip included 24 sets of rapids and waterfalls. That means they had to pull the canoes over to the side of the river, get out, unpack all of their supplies, that's tents, cooking equipment, rifles, fishing gear, warm clothes, and carry them by hand upriver. Families headed inland for the winter would carry something like 900 pounds of gear. Every year, they did that 24 times as they made their trip upriver.
Each of these portages were done on trails that had been established over millennia of living on the land. Generations of Pessimit, slowly creating paths that took them deeper and deeper into the wilderness. At the beginning of the trip, several families would caravan all together, but as they got further upstream, families would start to split off, each headed to their own trap lines, where they would spend the winter catching and eating big and small game.
They didn't just pick their winter territories randomly. This was an ancestral home. Trap lines are passed down, inherited from parent to child. These territories always included water. A river or set of lakes that kept them fed with fish and served as highways for getting around.
Marianne says this trip upriver took her and her family around a month and a half every year. In In the spring, after the ice melted off the rivers, she says they would gather up the furs that they had accumulated during the winter and ride the rivers, now swollen with spring meltwater, all the way back down to the ocean. From there, it was a short paddle to their summer village, Pessimit, where the whole community would gather for the summer months to sell their furs to white fur traders. They would restock with ammunition and warm clothing for the next winter, all the while fishing for salmon, seal, and lamprey.
This was the rhythm of Marianne's life, every year up and down the river. Shuffling from the silence and stillness of the winter hunting grounds, the place where she learned how to make snowshoes, where her grandparents broke with cultural norms and taught her to hunt and trap marten, caribou, moose, bear, and beaver, to the bustle of the summer village and trading post.
Louis Archambault translated for us.
She was interested to be here, but it was far from from being the best place for her. I mean, the best place for her to live was up there at Lac Pitipi. That was the place where she felt the best.
Now, imagine starting up the river, the same way that you'd done with your grandparents your entire life, coming around a bend, and instead of the falls you were expecting, seeing the river diverted and a massive construction project underway. Imagine looking to the riverbank for the portage trail, those footpaths that had been carved out over the course of generations, and finding many of them underwater. Where once you knew every rapid and riffle, every river bend, and where to take your canoe out and put it in again, now everything is unfamiliar.
That's exactly what happened to Marianne in the mid-1960s. She says she was in her 20s when the Outard River, the river she and her family had used for generations, was dammed. This is another Pessimit elder, Edgar Saint-Ange, describing that time.
Everything has been drowned. They lost all their gears. Their camps were flooded. Their equipment for to hunting equipment, trapping equipment was flooded. Their canoes, the nets to fish for the living of their family. Everything was lost without any kind of compensation.
I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it.
And I'm Hannah McCarthy, and you're listening to the second in a series called Powerline, stories about who has power, who wields it, and when you've got none, how do you take it?
As we learned in the last episode, in the 50s and 60s, Quebec launched a huge political project to build a new provincially owned electric utility, Hydro-Quebec. That company built a massive fleet of dams in order to provide good jobs for French-speaking Canadians. But as it did this, it was flooding land, land that had been used by Indigenous people for thousands of years.
Today on Outside In, we've got stories from two groups of Native people that grappled with Hydro-Quebec. Two stories that end in very different ways.
That dam Marianne Hervieux encountered out on the river, it was part of the Manic-Outard complex, Hydro-Quebec's very first mega project.
We're talking about dams that flooded hundreds of square miles along two massive rivers, powering seven powerhouses which can generate electricity for more than a million people.
But Hydro-Quebec never questioned one big assumption that their whole project rested on. Who owned the land that they were flooding?
Most of Quebec is what we call crown land. That means it belongs to the province.
This is David Schultz, the attorney for Pessimit. As far as the Canadian government was concerned, this land belonged to them.
And since Hydro-Quebec is what we call in Canada a crown corporation, it's a monopoly owned by the government of Quebec. The government of Quebec has no problem with its own company using its own land and rivers to build a hydro dam.
But did the land really belong to them? I mean, there were native people living here continuously for thousands of years before white European settlers arrived.
Unsurprisingly, European colonization brought issues of land rights. As settlers started to spread west across Canada, like as they got into Ontario and Manitoba, treaties were signed that officially transferred land from native people to the Canadian government.
A lot of really problematic treaties, of course.
However, in eastern Canada, a lot of settlement happened before that practice became common. There were no treaties. Native people had never signed their land rights away.
And that, of course, means there's some Aboriginal rights there to be dealt with. The question would be, though, okay, if you haven't taken surrender of those rights, how come you're allowed to go settle anyway, which is what you know, the British and then Canada tended to do? And we don't have, like, a very clear answer to that, because it would mean large parts of Canada are illegal.
So, David argues, there's this open legal question about whose land Hydro-Québec was building on, like, constitutionally.
And that brings us to the case he's working on. It goes back to this one story in 1972.
The construction was wrapping up on that first mega project, and as part of building it, Hydro-Québec was hoping to build a power line across Pessimitz Reservation.
The reservation, by the way, is the land that the federal government has explicitly set aside for the Pessimitte. No debate here. This was clearly native land, but it's a tiny, tiny chunk of what they had traditionally used for hunting and trapping.
Hydro-Québec figured crossing the reservation rather than going around would save them about $1 million. But this was not Crown land. They had to negotiate. So the company reaches out, not to the Pessimitte themselves, but to the federal government.
By law, Indian Affairs is the intermediary in any transaction like this concerning reserve land.
As intermediary, the Indian Affairs Department, now named Indigenous and Northern Affairs, was there to represent the Pessimitte in the negotiation, to act in their best interest.
And let's just highlight how weird this is. Indian Affairs, a government agency, was negotiating with Hydro-Québec, a Crown corporation. So it's kind of like the government negotiating with the government over this question of native rights.
If you're thinking, why didn't the Pessimitte negotiate for themselves? Well, at this time, Native people didn't have much in the way of their own bureaucracy set up to deal with stuff like this.
A band council office in the late 60s, early 70s was like a desk and a telephone.
When the negotiation started, the two parties were way far apart. Hydro's opening offer was a little more than $13,000.
The Pessimitte were looking for $2 million. Or free electricity forever. So they were at an impasse.
But over at Indian Affairs, something else was going on.
Between Hydro-Québec and Indian Affairs, they come up with this brilliant idea because, you know, Hydro-Québec wants to only...
The federal bureaucrats who represented the band council told Hydro-Québec they wanted at least $200,000. But Hydro-Québec wanted to hold the line at $50,000. So Indian Affairs proposes a compromise.
And they say, okay, $50,000 will be for crossing the reserve. And $150,000 will be for any damage you did to, you know, Innu fishing along all these rivers when you were damming them and building your hydroelectric infrastructure.
$200,000.
The actual language of the agreement? This money was for all impacts of any hydro development, not just on the tiny reservation, but all throughout the Pessimitte's massive traditional territory.
And the deal covered all damages, past, present, and future.
The band council took the money, and in the spring gave it out to every member of the Pessimitte community. It equaled a cash payout to each individual of $116. That's like $500 US today.
Well, it's, I have to say, even by the standards of the things I've seen, the agreement of 1973 that Indian Affairs negotiates for Pessimitte with Hydro-Québec is a bizarre story. It's not at all clear they have any idea that Indian Affairs is negotiating over their rights well beyond the reserve, you know, hundreds of miles beyond the reserve. And even if they did understand that, you don't get to deal with Aboriginal title that way.
Bessemit did live with hydro development at a time where it was differently done. Those projects were done with the laws in place at the time and the practices at the time.
That's Mathieu Boucher, manager of Hydro-Québec's Aboriginal Affairs.
I followed up with Hydro-Québec on this point, and a spokesperson sent back the following in a statement. To the best of our knowledge, there are no recognized historical treaties concerning the Bessemit Innu that Hydro-Québec may have violated. As part of its activities, Hydro-Québec ensures that users of the territory are consulted and that their concerns are taken into consideration.
Those are the last major projects that were done before James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement. And James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement really changed the way projects are done even in the whole country.
The James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement. Remember those words.
Because in order to understand why the Bessemit are so upset about what happened to them, you have to hear another story about another Hydro-Québec deal made just 2 years later.
And this one went very, very differently. And we'll tell you that story after a break.
Before we go any farther, I think we need some First Nations 101 here.
Right, yeah. So we've been talking about the Bessemit. Bessemit is the name of the community, and the Bessemit are members of the Innu Nation and speak the Innu language.
Innu, not Inuit. The Inuit are further north.
So the Bessemit Innus.
And now we're leaving the Bessemit Innus behind to talk about a different nation.
The Crees, specifically the Eastern Crees. They live to the north of the Innus. Their reservations are hundreds, even thousands of miles apart. But if you look at their winter territories, where they would hunt and trap, they were basically neighbors.
And this story starts with Robert Kanatawat.
My name is Robert Kanatawat. I'm from Chesapeake.
Robert is getting on in years. He's in his 80s. Soft-spoken, but opinionated.
Well, people call me, I made history. Maybe so, but, you know, I started it all. I was the first one that started this whole Native movement.
So Robert Kanatawat was chief of Chesapeake, a reservation which local people often abbreviate and call Chesapeake. And back in the early 70s, there was some really big news brewing, news that he didn't know anything about.
One of the native people, Philip Owashis, is my colleague. Apparently, he happened to be down south at that time, and then he saw in the newspaper what Hydro was planning to do with the north.
This colleague wanted to get the word out.
Well, at the very beginning, you know, we had a hard time about communication. At that time, we only had what you call radio.
So Philip Owashis starts a phone tree, and the message starts getting passed around, calling from chief to chief in the aid communities, leaving messages, trying to get the word out to folks who are out hunting on their family's traditional territory.
He passed it on to someone, someone, to someone, someone, to someone, and someone, and all the way down the line.
The news was big. The premier of Quebec had run on a platform of creating 100,000 new jobs, and part of his plan was to build the hydropower project of the century, spanning an area the size of France. In all, the proposal would divert 9 rivers out of their channels and funnel most of them into a massive new reservoir. All of these rivers would flow into Le Grand. That's the river that flows past Chesapeake.
This was Hydro-Québec's second mega project,
the James Bay project. And so far, Hydro-Québec was following the same game plan. No advanced notice for the Crees, the people actually living on these water bodies.
So the chiefs all gathered for a big meeting.
And right away, everybody talked about the land, trying to protect it because they're going to destroy what we lived on and what we survived on and so on, and what our ancestors survived and passed it on to our forefathers.
The Crees decided to lawyer up.
They united with the Inuit, whose land was also impacted by the proposal, and filed an injunction.
As a matter of fact, the court battle is in my name. Robert Kanadwad versus et al. And so on, you know.
He says whenever he gets introduced to anyone who has studied Canadian law, they're a little starstruck.
Yeah, I know. I know. I've seen his name, you know.
The Crees argued that these projects would significantly impact their traditional subsistence economy, the hunting and trapping, the traveling up and down rivers, the seasonal ebb and flow of a quasi-nomadic lifestyle.
But more to the point, the Crees argued that this was their land. They had never signed it away in treaties with the Canadians, and they had been using it for thousands of years.
And this is what made us fight, because we wanted to retain our identity as Native people, once that lived off the land, and this is where we made our survival from.
Hydro-Québec argued that this way of life that the Crees said they were trying to protect didn't really exist anymore. They argued that the Crees now used snowmobiles, that they used chainsaws, that they ate toast.
Yeah, this was actually an argument used in court, made by lawyers. In part, it was a strategy. Canadian law guarantees Native people the right to hunt and fish, to live this traditional lifestyle. So if Hydro-Québec could prove this traditional lifestyle was no longer in practice, it could argue they had no right to stop the project.
So the Crees called people off their trap lines.
And then what we did, we brought in trappers. They testified.
The trappers talked about how they lived and worked on the land, how they moved from place to place on their huge winter trap lines.
Or in those days, people traveled by foot, by snowshoes, by dock team.
Of course, it was also true that they used snowmobiles and float planes, too, and even that they ate toast sometimes. But this is kind of a weird argument when you think about it. It's like arguing that for a culture to exist, it can never change. It's like arguing that for Native people to be Native people, they have to agree to never adopt a new technology.
And in the end, the Crees won the judge over.
So they had to empty all the work sites. So all construction stopped for a week.
That's Réal Courcelle.
Réal has watched this whole history develop from the other side of the negotiating table. He's worked for Hydro-Québec for 42 years.
So I started back in 1975. My role here is to negotiate agreement and see to their implementation with the Crees.
You won the injunction and they stopped work?
We won the injunction, and we also knew that they would realize now that they can't just push us around.
This decision landed like a thunderbolt. A Canadian judge had sided with Native people. He had stopped construction of the dam and acknowledged that the Crees had some sort of right to the land even hundreds of years after white settlers had moved in.
Then the Court of Appeal just overturned the decision of the Superior Court, but imposing on the parties to negotiate an agreement.
So construction did get underway again, but Hydro-Québec had to sit down and cut a deal with the Crees. Violet Pachano was working as a secretary for the Grand Council when they got the first offer. She later went on to be chief of Chesapeake and deputy grand chief of the whole Grand Council.
That's when they tabled the letter to the chiefs with an offer from the premier of Quebec.
So that was the beginning of, that was the first offer in the negotiation.
Yeah. Two-pager or three-pager.
How many pages was the final agreement?
Yeah, we're 200 pages maybe.
And remember, as they hammered out these negotiations, construction on the dams continued.
So I think one of the basic things was, well, even if we continue fighting it, it's going to be built anyway. So let's get what we can and do what we can, see how it goes.
And in 1975, they reached a final deal, and it was massive. It was called the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement, and it was about much more than just the dams. It totally reimagined the relationship between the Canadian government, the Quebec government, and the Cree people.
It created a whole new system of land management in the Cree territory and gave them a say in future development. It created a Cree school board and a board of health.
What they say, you know, is that we weren't the owners of the land. You know, they kept saying that. And we said that we managed to convince that they are trespassing, you know, that they should pay for taking our land, our resources, our livelihood, and the way we want to live.
And then there was the money. The straight-up compensation. Remember the Pessimit? They got $150,000 and forfeited all their rights to future damages caused by Hydro-Québec's dams.
In contrast, just 2 years later, the James Bay Agreement awarded the Crees $135 million. To put this another way, the Crees were paid 900 times what the Pessimit received.
It's like where the Pessimit thought there was just a solid wall, something that they would never get over, the Crees had come along right after them and put in a key and opened the door.
But this whole story, even for the Crees, it left raw feelings.
Cree leaders would later say, negotiating this deal while the dams were still under construction, it was like cutting a deal with a gun to your head.
They signed the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement under duress. And that's the case. You went in court. The court overturned the decision, and it's still a fact. But the good thing of it, we have all learned about that, and we are not doing things the same way that we have done in 75.
And those raw feelings, they are especially concentrated in one place, the community of Chesapeake, where Robert Conotowat was chief. We could still feel it when we visited this summer, nearly 45 years later.
Chesapeake, you could have seen it. You went to Chesapeake. They will never love Hydro-Québec. That's for sure. Never. It will take generation and generation.
In the end, what do these two stories tell us? To a certain extent, it's just that history is kind of random and fickle.
Here's David Schultz again, the Pessimit's lawyer.
So I guess what I would ask is, like, you know, if we compare what the Pessimit got versus what the Cree got, like, how can we explain the contrast between these two deals?
That is a great question of Quebec law and politics. How can we explain that the Cree have the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement and that all sorts of other First Nations in Quebec have just their little Indian Act reserves and their little Indian Affairs budgets because they didn't get an injunction, because they weren't... They didn't have the potential to block the project of the century because they weren't in court and fighting quite as hard in court the same way at quite the right time.
But this was in 1975, and while the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement was huge and remade the landscape of how Canada, its provinces, and First Nations interacted, it was, in many ways, just the beginning.
So after that... when all was signed, and then that's when the real fight started.
Pessimit is fighting against giants who have huge amount of money.
Is the contract in jeopardy? The contract is in jeopardy. If by that you mean, is it possible that the contract could be canceled? Absolutely.
Hydro-Québec had no option but to cancel the project.
If you want to hear the rest of our Powerline series, which originally aired in 2017, you can find it at our website, outsideinradio.org. Just look for the tab at the top of the site that says Powerline. Outside In was produced this week by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Hannah McCarthy, and Taylor Quimby, with help from Jimmy Gutierrez, Ben Henry, Nick Capodice, Daniel Barrick, Justine Paradise, Felix Poon, and Maureen McMurray. Remember, Outside In is also a podcast. If you never want to miss an episode, search for Outside/In on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One, or wherever you get your podcasts. Remember, on podcasts, you can even hit pause if you want to be sure you don't miss anything. Music in this week's episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, and our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.